coming up on 8 p.m. here at WBAI New York. It must be time for Out FM. So stay tuned for that program, heard every Tuesday at 8.
And you're listening to Out FM on WBAI New York. The song you just heard was Together by Betty. Out FM covers the lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, two-spirit, intersex, queer, and questioning communities from a progressive perspective on listener-sponsored WBAI New York. I'm John Riley, and I'm joined by Bob. Would you like to introduce yourself? Well, that's Bob Lederer. And tonight we're focusing on sexual abuse committed by nuns. Out FM is interviewing two members of the Survivor Network for those abused by priests and nuns.
That's Bob Lederer. And tonight we're focusing on sexual abuse.
We've got a little bit of a discrepancy here in terms of some sort of strange feedback. Out FM is interviewing two members of the Survivor Network for those abused by priests and nuns, for short. My guests are Mary Dispenza, a former nun, and Paige Anderson, who are both leaders in SNAP and both are lesbians. Both women were abused by nuns as youths, very young, young women. The segment begins with a song titled Torture by the Netherlands Radio Choir and Radio Philharmonic, as well as, and it's also, it's conducted by Maestro Stephen Mercurio. So let's listen. Since the 1980s, the Catholic Church and many other churches have been exposed as having a significant percentage of clergy that engage in abuse of their rank and file membership, including children, adolescents, and young adults. Last week, we talked to several members of the Survivor Network of those abused by priests and nuns. This week, we've invited two SNAP members back to discuss this little discussed topic, which is those abused by nuns. For many, it's not hard to believe that male clergy would engage in abuse, but nuns have been seen as not very likely to engage in physical, psychological, or sexual abuse. But for Mary Dispenza and Paige Anderson, they've experienced this type of abuse from nuns, and we're here to talk about this phenomena. Joining us is Paige Epstein Anderson, whose pronouns are she and her, and she believes in the power of the underdog to make positive change in the world. She's a survivor of grooming and sexual abuse by a female theology teacher who later became a Catholic sister. A graduate of Harvard Divinity School, Paige engaged in academic therapy, studying Catholic sisters and their evolution after Vatican II. Paige now uses her background to advocate for a statute of limitation reform in her home state of Pennsylvania. A graduate admissions professional by day, Paige and her wife spend weekends watching their goalkeeper son on the field in Durham, North Carolina. Also joining us is Mary Dispenza. Her pronouns are she and her, and she's a former Catholic nun, educator, and national distinguished principal. She is an activist for LGBTQIA plus rights and an international speaker and writer. She's a survivor of sexual assault at the age of 7 by the parish priest and abused by a nun when she was a postulant. Mary is the national SNAP leader and contact for those abused by nuns. She's the author of the award-winning memoir, Split, A Child, a Priest, and the Catholic Church. So welcome to both of you to Out FM. Mary believes our individual and collective stories have the power to change us. Mary lives with her wife in Bellevue, Washington. So welcome to Out FM, Paige Anderson and Mary Dispenza. Mary, can you begin by talking about the abuse you suffered at the hands of a priest and a nun?
Yes, and thanks, John and Naomi, for having us on. We really are grateful. I do believe in the power of story, and that stories have the power to change us. So a bit about my story, I'll do it in two parts. First, about my priest abuse, and then nun abuse. So I grew up in East Los Angeles and went to Catholic school. And my mom drove the school bus. So I had the joy of seeing a school bus parked in my driveway and had the joy of picking up little kids. And my mother also worked in the parish rectory. And that became a perfect place for her to be groomed by the priest. Sometimes we forget that parents are groomed also, and in my case, my mom groomed by the priest. He gained her trust, and that helped him have access to me. And I was 7 years old at the time, and I went looking for my mom at lunchtime one day. She was on her break from working in the rectory, and I found her in the lunchroom. And she was talking to the lunchroom ladies, and I went over and stood by her for a while, but it got very boring. The conversation was just nothing much I was interested in. So I went into the adjoining hall, which was called the auditorium back then, and I opened the door, left the cafeteria, and went in, and I noticed that it was dark. It had never been dark before. At least as a second grader, I was never in it when it was dark. So that was like intriguing in a way. And up front, there was a screen with a picture showing on it. I don't even know that I knew what a movie screen was, but there was a movie playing on this screen up front. And I also noticed a machine with a light coming from it. And it captivated me, and the light drew me toward it, and kind of a metaphor, it drew me toward it, and in that moment, darkness. So I went toward the projector, and I remember the whirring sound of it, and I went up closer and closer, and I noticed the priest was sitting right by this machine. And he motioned me to sit on his lap. And of course I did, because even at age 7, I learned that he was God. The priest was God. So why would I not sit on his lap? And I was really so excited to be so close to that machine and watch those wheels go around and hear the sound. And And then in a moment, I felt his arms really hold me very tightly. And he then put his hands under my panties and into my vagina. And in that moment, everything stopped. The projector stopped. I stopped. And in that moment, I say I split. A part of me left my body, and I dissociated. And then I just remember the priest walking me to the back of the dark auditorium and leaving me there. And in my book, I write, I'm standing in darkness while he goes into the light of day. And I went in the small bathroom and I washed my hands and thinking that would make me clean. And I left little Mary on the bathroom floor that day. And it was a long time before I went back to reclaim her. And I think that first occasion was the beginning of a 3-year time for his name was Father Neville Rucker to continue to abuse me. And I buried the story like many of us do. We dissociate. And I left it until I was 52 years old. I buried it deep inside me, other than one occasion when I was in the 7th grade and I went to receive the sacrament of confirmation. And for a split second, I woke up when I looked up on the altar and saw the priest. And I remember saying to myself, that's the man. And I had words then and added that raped me. But the sad part in that piece is that I had to go to him to wipe the holy oils from my forehead during a sacramental moment. And so again, it was 52 when I finally had the courage. I was brave enough to let that story surface. And the rest of the story is too long to share, but I do confront my abuser in eventually. And that's a whole nother story. And I did hold him accountable and joined several other women to file suit against him. And on record, he abused at least 35 to 40 little girls. And that's probably just a third of all that he really abused, because sexual abuse is always underreported. And also another very tragic piece is this particular priest was passed on for 4 decades to go on to abuse and abuse and abuse. And that's unconscionable on the part of those in charge, the pastor, the bishops, everyone. So that's a little bit about my story of clergy abuse. And then I'd like to share about my story of nun abuse. I entered the convent when I was 18 years old and I remained for 15 years. I was a teacher and a school principal. And I was so out of touch with myself to begin with because I had the priest abuse buried deep inside of me. And my sexual development wasn't very developed. So that's always a problem with many of us that entered a long time ago. But when I was a postulant, that means the first year of my life in the convent, we went down to our main chapel, and there were 13 of us. We always stayed on a line and formation, and we walked down to the chapel and went in for prayers. And then when I was coming out of the chapel, I had to go through, we walked through a courtyard where the nuns lived who taught in the boarding school there. And a superior that I knew, but I really didn't know her. I just knew her from seeing her and knowing that she was the superior of the school. She tapped me on my shoulder, and I knew I needed to follow her. And she motioned to me, and I followed her into her room. And just that piece in itself was very frightening for me, because I never left that formation line. We were never allowed to be out of the sight of the novice mistress. So I went into her room, and she sat down in her chair. And in those days, we had to kneel before the superior whenever we talked to them or needed anything. So I knelt down, which is already a very submissive position. And I don't remember what she said before or after, but she took my face between her hands and she kissed me all over my face. And I don't know what she said again after. I just remember leaving and feeling the same types of feelings I had when I was raped by the priest. I felt alone. I felt abandoned. I felt afraid. I felt scared. I felt lost. And so the priest abuse complicated that event, because it wasn't egregious abuse such as I heard. However, it left me totally confused. And I'm less confused now than I was then, but it took me all into my 70s to finally name that event as sexual abuse, especially abuse of power, that kind of crossed over into spirituality and all. And for a long, long time, especially after I left the community, I would be with my women friends talking about our relationships, and I would share this story. And they would always say things like, well, that's weird. That's quirky. And we'd kind of leave it at that. But finally, as I said, in my 70s, I said, no, that wasn't just a quirky, weird story. That was abuse. And that was a moment for me when things came together and finally I could name it for what it was. And it doesn't really matter how egregious it was. It left me confused. And even till this day, I'm saying what many survivors say, especially in relationship to non-abuse. Maybe she loved me. Maybe it was about love. Maybe it was abuse. So there's always this, oftentimes in some of the stories I hear, there's this confusion because the survivor really felt, believed, loved. And then at some point they tease it all apart and have to face that, no, that wasn't love. That was abuse. I may have, not I, but a survivor may have loved the perpetrator, but generally, mostly always, the perpetrator is abusive in using the person for his or her personal pleasure.
Wow, that's a very sad, moving story. You're listening to Out FM on WBAI New York. I'm John Riley. Tonight's show is presenting two members of the Survivor Network for Those Abused by Priests and Nuns, or SNAP for short. Tonight we're focusing on abuse committed by nuns. My guests are Mary Dispenza, a former nun, and Paige Anderson, who were both abused by nuns and both leaders in SNAP. The music is titled Torture by the Netherlands Choir and Philharmonic. The interview continues.
that nuns would be abusers, I think for some, it's unthinkable. However, SNAP treasurer Dan McNevin talks about the dynamic.
I'm happy to do that. I am a board member of Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Also on the call, we have Zach Heiner, who's our executive director. And I'm a survivor of priest abuse. And when I was talking with Mary about this live stream, it occurred to me that the issue of nun abuse is at a point where priest abuse was in the 80s. It's an unrevealed aspect of sex abuse in the Catholic Church. Back in the 80s, the first headlines really hit. Gilbert Goth of Louisiana hit the press as a serial abuser. And I remember reading that article and reflecting on the fact that it happened to me too, but I didn't think that it happened to anybody else. And it was years and years before we discovered that even in the 80s, there were already decades of abuse occurring, tens of thousands of survivors, thousands of priests who had abused. And we now know that at least 7,000 priests have abused in the United States, and we have tens of thousands of survivors. Nun abuse is in the very, very early stages of being revealed, and I don't know how big these numbers will get. We have Terry McKiernan here from bishopsaccountability.org, and he's a historian and an archivist, and he and his organization have been tracking priest abuse for a long time. And the only way that we are getting information about nun abuse is through the hard process of survivors coming forward. There are lists being published by diocese and by religious male orders, but none by religious female orders. And so as we talk today, I think Terry will weigh in, so will Paul Abramson, who's a psychologist, an expert at sexual abuse, an expert witness, and a professor. I believe that we will learn a lot today, but I also think that over the next two decades, we are going to discover that the abuse situation among nuns is as terrible and as dark as the abuse situation among priests.
And that was SNAP board member Dan McNevin. He's the treasurer of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests and Nuns. Mary Dispenza, you're a SNAP leader. You're a contact for those abused by nuns. Can you address the number of abusive nuns and the types of abuse you learned about through the support group that you've been involved with?
Yes, and I just want to say a thank you to Dan McNevin. I've had the pleasure of working with him from about 2018, and we did put a report together back then to present at the SNAP conference, and what he's saying is true. It's been hard and long to get real data and information because the religious orders are very closed to giving any helpful information to us. So it's been very difficult. But I wanted to read one of the statistics that came out of our 2018 work that Dan, he said, if an average of 65,000 nuns have served in the United States over the past 50 years and 2% have abused, there are 1,300 abusive nuns, most of whom have not been identified. And that's stunning in that Bishop Accountability, the database has only about 160 plus credible stories given to them. So many stories are not been told. And of course, no one held accountable. So survivors are not finding any justice or recourse to healing in that regard. But in my own work, probably again from about 2018, I think it's fair to say I stopped counting, but it's fair to say that I've talked to 200 to 300 survivors and heard their stories and a little bit about their journey. And what I realized is there are so many different types of abuse on the part of nuns. And sometimes we are stunned and shocked to realize that nuns within orders who have power often have been known to abuse their sisters in their own orders, to sexually abuse or abuse by control. And that is so sad. Having been a nun, I can't imagine living in a community where my abuser is there and with superiors who would do nothing to remove her or even remove me. But in a story, the nun who was abused by a nun who had power over her was living and had to live in the same community. So that's a type of abuse that I've heard more and more of since having this work. And it's also reminds us, we talk about abuse within religious communities among themselves as sort of an incestuous family. Because there's a secrecy that develops. You don't want to tell about your sisters, so to speak. And it's very similar to that. And then the other abuse boys, when I have had calls from men who were abused by nuns, I always hear a strong piece of shame. And I believe it's connected to the fact that a woman abused them. And as males, you know, we're to rise above situations and be the strong one. But in this case, the nuns had the power and often abused boys, and some that I have heard stories of have been physical abuse, sexual abuse, and I say emotional abuse, where the boys were embarrassed and publicly shamed by the nun. Maybe one situation I recall is a boy wanting and needing to use the restroom and the nun making him stand until the point where he wet himself, and he carries that terrible, terrible shame today. And the physical abuse boys, one boy was literally knocked unconscious by a nun. And dealing with that is sometimes a lifelong journey. And many girls that have shared stories with me that were abused by nuns are always complicated with different layers, because so often the nun preyed on their emotional, psychological, sexual growth development to the point where the survivor felt truly loved and loved the nun. And then a day comes when the survivor has to pull that all apart and say, did I make that up? She was loving me, wasn't she? No, she couldn't have abused me and known that. And so it's just a real tough journey. And Paige will be sharing a little bit about that. And the other stories I've shared, and not to a great degree, but we forget about ritual abuse. There's been a good few survivors who were a part of ritual abuse, meaning where sometimes priests and nuns came together and engaged in putting survivors on altars and doing egregious acts with them. So it's really quite a broad spectrum of types of abuse, and so under reflected, it's just not not out to the degree that we need to be looking at. And then when we can think of the indigenous children who about 2 years ago, there were articles out on uncovering the bones of little children that were buried in unmarked cemeteries and graves, largely at the hands of priests, but nuns who were terribly, terribly complicit. They either set up the children for the priests, or they did indeed torture and molest themselves.
Moving to Dr. Paul Abramson, Dr. Paul Abramson is a SNAP member and psychologist at UCLA, and he discusses how abuse plays itself out.
I also want to say that I'm honored to be part of this group. My full name is Dr. Paul Abramson. I'm a professor of psychology at UCLA. I worked in clergy abuse cases for over 40 years. There's three things that are true about all perpetrators, and these are important to keep in mind. The first is that they put themselves in a position to gain access to kids. The second is that they exploit their position of authority to add credence to the behavior they're doing that, you know, legitimizes it. The third and the most important thing to keep in mind, always keep in mind, is that the greatest threat to a perpetrator is disclosure. They groom their victims not to gain sexual access, but instead to create a bond that will eliminate disclosure, disclosure being telling a parent or telling law enforcement and so on. The durability of the secret of non-abuse is really testimony to the effectiveness to which they've groomed their victims. And their device largely is love, love or gifts and so forth. They create such a bond with their victim that the victims don't disclose. Now, the psychologically devastating part of this sexual abuse by nuns is that it's no less of a sexual crime and a significant challenge to faith, but it's the betrayal when you realize, or the victim realizes, that it was a calculated and ruthless strategy that at its core has contempt for the psychological needs of its victims. If this nun truly cared about the lifelong psychological needs of her victims, why would she ever saddle that victim with a lifetime of struggling with the impact of sexual abuse? The fact of the matter is that she never cared about her victim, but to get what she wanted, she knew that love was the quickest route, and it was the strongest protection against disclosure.
And that was Dr. Paul Abramson, a SNAP member and psychologist at UCLA, discussing how abuse plays out in many situations. You're listening to Out FM on WBAI New York. I'm John Riley. Tonight's show is presenting two members of the Survivor Network for those abused by priests and nuns, or SNAP for short. Tonight we're focusing on abuse committed by nuns. My guests are Mary Dispenza, a former nun, and Paige Anderson, who were both abused by nuns and both leaders in SNAP. The music is titled Torture by the Netherlands Choir and Philharmonic. The interview continues. Paige Anderson, can you talk about the abuse you endured as an adolescent and young adult and how that affected your sexual development and other relationships?
Sure. First, John, thank you for having me on the show today and discussing this important topic. In my case, my abuse happened relatively recent in the 1990s, so not so distant past. I was a 16-year-old student at a Catholic high school in Pennsylvania when I was groomed extensively by a female theology teacher at my high school. Shortly after I turned 18, she took me out of state to a college visit where things escalated into sexual assault, and this continued throughout my senior year. The most shocking part for me is that when I went to college, she called me in the spring and told me that she was joining the Order of Sisters who were serving at my high school. And I realized that she had exploited my internal struggles between faith and my desire to teach theology with my acknowledgement of my sexual orientation as a lesbian. And I blame myself for what happened. And I believe that I had driven her into the convent. So her grooming definitely impacted my struggle. And to reconcile what she told me was an expression of love with what it really was, sexual assault by an educator that I trusted as a mentor and someone who became a sister and was supposed to uphold the, you know, the vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience. You know, to make things more complex, I think that this was my first sexual experience with a woman. And where I felt authentically myself, and yet she told me not to tell anyone. And this really led to immense shame and guilt, as Dr. Alluded to. You know, the abuse was undoubtedly impacted my identity formation and relationships. Since that time, I've struggled with depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. I have issues of trust and definitely hypervigilance, especially in relation to my son and his interaction with strangers and even at school. And it wasn't really until about 2 years ago that I finally had that aha moment where I really began to place blame on her as a teacher and a person in a position of authority and power, who really took advantage of me as a naive kid navigating, you know, internalized homophobia in a very conservative Catholic space in Pennsylvania. And I'm hoping that by speaking now, I can raise awareness about sexual abuse so that others do not have to endure kind of the scars that I carry with me today and struggle with.
Paige, your bio has a personal statement, quote, "For me, the complexity of Catholic non-abuse is that they are victims of abuse within and outside their communities, perpetrators within."
Sure. I think the issue is complex. I think that issues of gender, I think issues of power, all kind of come together in this sense. And Mary and I know members of our group, you know, who are thinking about tangible ways to really break the cycle of this, of abuse within as facilitators, perpetrators, and victims. And first, I would say, I think some strategies that we would want to see is that there's an organization that Mary alluded to called the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. And up to this point, they've really not had honest dialogue with survivors and invited us in for conversations. I attempted to reach out to the former president of LCWR about my own case. And she basically said, take it up with the order. And so I think that they need to acknowledge the abuse within their own communities, as well as those who have been victimized by sisters. I also think religious communities really need to have some clear, transparent policies about how they deal with perpetrators, and victims of sexual abuse. And they should make those policies public. There's been a lack of transparency around policies and what communities are doing. And if they do exist, they're often behind firewalls. I also think dioceses and religious orders could do more to publish names of individuals who are credibly accused of abuse, and to also engage in some restorative justice with survivors, of which we have been largely ignored. I also think there's an opportunity for the LCWR and for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops to engage in some generative work around some recent changes in canon law that have been about abuse and more inclusion of women and men who are in religious orders and not just clergy. Because for a long time, clergy abuse had been very much equated to male priests. So I'm hoping that going forward, there's they can perhaps have some creative synergy around updating the Dallas Charter to be more inclusive. And finally, as I note in my bio, I think it's very important to make some positive changes at the state and federal level regarding statute of limitation reform for child sexual abuse and abuse of vulnerable peoples. You know, there are many changes that have taken place. I know that Pennsylvania has upped the statute of limitations for civil remedies to 55. However, those measures are not retroactive. And so survivors like myself are unable to seek civil or criminal justice through the courts. And so in my home state, you know, those who were abused in the Catholic Church, but also in schools, nonprofits, other faith organizations and government organizations have been waiting for 15 years for legislation to pass for a look back window like New York has had through the Child Victims Act. So that we might seek justice and hold institutions accountable for, you know, our perpetrators and the organizations like the Catholic Church that harbor them.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's like this is something that's been going on in the rest of society, but it seems like the Catholic Church has been like living decades and decades in the past in terms of reform. That where colleges and universities have dealt with this across the country. Mary Dispenza, can you talk very briefly about the YouTube video that you were a part of with 15 other survivors that can't be shown on Facebook? Why is Facebook afraid of survivors telling their stories?
Well, I'm really not sure. And I believe just because they decided it had sexual content, instead of seeing the goodness in the piece, which was letting survivors know they are not alone and letting them hear stories and gain some hope and all. And I went today on the internet looking for the answer to that question. I didn't find anything that even said what I just said. So I don't really know. In this case, I think it wasn't just ruling, because if they had watched that video, I think that they would have not found it offensive in any way. So it was a joy to make it and to have all my sisters in this case. And there are men also, but they aren't a part. They didn't have the opportunity to share their stories. This woman I'd like to just mention, Marilyn Shannon, her work in the world is a program called Breaking Free. And I met her, my goodness, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I think I found her on the internet, and I had two programs were aired on the topic before we had the third one, which allowed us to form the panel and tell our stories.
Well, it's a very interesting panel. I encourage listeners that want to hear more and find out about this situation to go to the snapnetwork.org website and scroll down until you get to the nun abuse little red box. And so that's all we have time for. I want to thank Paige Anderson and Mary Dispenza for your incredible participation and very moving stories and clear analysis. So thank you both for being on Out FM.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Out FM on WBAI
New York. I'm John Riley, and I'm joined by Bob Lederer. Bob?
Good evening to all the listeners. That was a very powerful segment. Thank you for putting that together, John.
Well, it's something I feel deeply important that the Catholic Church be confronted on these kind of issues. They've ruined so many people's lives. So, and from the sexual abuse itself to the sort of very sex negative attitudes that the church has taught for millennia. So on tonight's show, for those that may have just tuned in, Mary Dispenza, a former nun, and Paige Anderson, who are both lesbians, were talking to us about how they were abused by female clergy in the Catholic Church. Both are members of the Survivor Network for those abused by priests and nuns, or SNAP for short. The song that you heard as an interlude was called Torture, and it was performed by the Netherlands Radio Choir and Philharmonic, as well as Maestro Mercuria. So now is the time that we are asking for your support. WBAI is almost completely supported by listeners just like you. WBAI doesn't get money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, so your support is absolutely essential to pay the expensive bills for tower rent on the top of Four Times Square and the small paid staff that's at the station. Over the past year, we brought you stories ranging from a report about the Philippine LGBTQI movement at the intersection of class and gender politics there. We also brought you interviews with Swedish professor Kat Kiel and Goran Therborn talking about the rise of the neo-Nazi right in Sweden and how the neo-Nazi right attempted to manipulate the gay movement for advantage, but were thwarted, luckily. However, they still came to power, which is an atrocity. And we've also brought you interviews with Professor Lori Marhoefer, who talked about her book, Sex in the Weimar Republic, which is about the German gay movement and the rise of the Nazis. So one of the issues that we think is really important to take seriously is the rise of fascism, and that's why we have done a number of programs on the topic of right-wing extreme politics. So Bob, can you talk a little bit about some of the segments you've done? And
sure, I'd be happy to. I've been working on a series that has aired many times on Out FM for the past few years called Queerly Defiant. And it's about LGBTQ plus activists on the left who have faced the wrath of the state. It could be the federal government, it could be the state government, but because of their commitment to social justice and radical change in society, they have had to deal with those kinds of repressive tactics. And we've really met some remarkable people. And one of the most thrilling interviews that I was able to do when it was aired in three parts was with the author of a new book released last year, Bettina Apthaker, called Communists in Closets. It was about members of the Communist Party USA who had to endure from 1938 to 1991 an absolute ban on lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, from being members if they openly acknowledged their queerness. And Bettina did a wonderful job after exhaustive research and interviewing those surviving members who wanted to talk to her about that reality. And incidentally, the gift item that we offered on the weeks of those programs are still available for those of you who might be interested. So the number to call, and by the way, this is for any donation at any level that you want to give, whether it's just to become a $25 member or whether you'd like to get this book, Communists in Closets, for a $50 donation, or whether it's a larger amount. We welcome all help that anyone can provide to this struggling radio station. And the number to call is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And on the web, it's give to WBAI.org. And that's give to WBAI.org. And there's actually quite a lot of interesting gifts that you can choose. We hope that you'll note in the drop-down menu that you listen to Out FM. But whatever amount and whatever way you want to make your contribution, we are very, very grateful, and we thank you. Again, 212-209-2950 or give to WBAI.org.
And our program director has been calling also for people to donate to the Tower Fund, and that will help pay the bill for the tower, which is about $17,000 a month. And there's no way around it. If you want a radio signal in New York City, you got to have a tower that's way above the rest of the skyline. So hope you can do that. 212-209-2950. If you'd like to be a sustaining member of WBAI, we call our sustaining member program the Buddy Program. And, you know, you can go to the website, WBAI.org, and there'll be a little box that says become a buddy, a BAI buddy. So, and you can give any amount. We suggest, you know, starting at $10 or $20 if you can afford it. But it can really be any amount. So, you can put it on your credit card and just plan ahead for the whole year, you know? So, we'd love that.
Yeah. Get
212-209-2950.
That's right. Let me put in a special plug for the BAI Buddy. That's from our end, it's a reliable monthly amount of money that will keep the lights on, keep the broadcast signal going, and it gives us some peace of mind. On your end, of course, it's painless. Once you do the initial transaction for a few quick minutes, the money will be seamlessly reviewed or removed from your bank account or your credit card every month. And you'll have the good feeling that you're doing something very concrete that's helping keep this listener-sponsored, free speech, progressive venue alive and well. And corporate media is really increasingly crowding out independent media like WBAI and Pacifica, and they're disappearing left and right, and particularly disappearing on the left. And so we hope that you will make your contribution to prevent the disappearance of WBAI, to keep that signal strong.
That's right. That's right. And unfortunately, we're hearing that there are discussions at top levels of Pacifica about potential things like signal swaps and sales of buildings and things like that throughout the network. So it makes a difference if you can, you know, keep BAI going, keep it strong. If we can get, you know, this Tower Fund together, that's going to really be an important stabilizing factor for the station's finances. I did want to also talk about, you know, we do some obituaries, and we tend to do that for people that, you know, have lived exemplary lives, that were activists, that gave a lot to the community, and have done them for people like Jerry Meyer, who is a radical gay man and teacher at Holstos Community College. We also did it for bisexual labor activist and radical Toby Emmer,
who supported political prisoners throughout her life and dedicated much of her life to trying to get them out of prison. And we also did coverage of the murder of anti-racist activist June Knightley, a lesbian killed in Portland while protecting demonstrators that were at a demonstration from violent attacks, which they had been experiencing. So those are just some of the things, just as a reminder of the kinds of work that we do. We tend to function at the intersections of race and class and gender. And anyway, we hope you find it illuminating. So 212-209-2950 is where you can call to give your donation. Please mention Out FM. But regardless of whether you mention our name or not, please give. It's just so important to keep this valuable institution alive. Anyway, that's about it for time. I just want to quickly thank our guests, Mary Dispensa and Paige Anderson, as well as their colleagues, Dan McNevin and Dr. Paul Abramson. And the whole Survivors Network for those abused by priests and nuns. I'm John Riley, and
I'm Bob Lederer.
And stay tuned to the station, and we'll be back next week. And just stay strong and play close attention and go to the phone, 212-209-2950.
Or online, give to WBAI.org. Good night, everyone. Check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing. Tune into Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright on Tuesday, January 24th at 9 p.m. will be joined by filmmakers Stephen Fischler and Joe Sucher to discuss their films on American radicalism, including From Swastika to Jim Crow and Red Squad, among the latest streaming releases from Ovid's collection, Anarchy in the USA.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
Yes, they're radical cats.
Aren't they all?
Extinction Diaries. There are 22 species in the albatross family, of which 17 are globally threatened, according to BirdLife. Albatrosses are the largest seabirds. They soar effortlessly, spending much of their lives aloft. Males and females engage in elaborate courtship displays to find a mate and strengthen a bond that typically lasts for life. Albatrosses fly hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles in search of food for their chicks. Their diet consists of squid and fish eggs that float on the surface of water. Unfortunately, most plastics float, and albatross are particularly attracted to it. They ingest the floating pieces, fly back to the nest, and feed this plastic trash to their young. The chicks starve to death, their stomachs full of plastic. You can help the albatross and all sea life by recycling and refusing to use or buy any single-use plastic. And it's time to demand that plastic is categorized for what it is, an extinction certainty, and made illegal. My name is Aaron Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
Hey, I can't find that on the radio.
Well, tune in to WBAI, and you certainly will get an earful.
Yo, turn to that station.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
And you can ensure that WBAI is here for you now and in the future through WBAI's Tower Fund. Go to towerfund.wbai.org and contribute what you can to ensure that the room which houses WBAI's transmitter at 4 Times Square, which costs $17,000 a month, is paid through the coming year. Please go to towerfund@wbai.org or phone 212-209-2950 to help secure WBAI's future.
Thank you to all of you for contributing. And we hope that you will decide to make a contribution in support.